Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I discovered this practice 50 years ago, and I was very excited to find it. I was very enthusiastic. It was like, wow, this is wonderful. I thought, oh, this is just what I need. So today, 50 years later, I'm still enthusiastic. Not as excitable. Not as excited as I was on the first day, you know. But I still feel, and more than ever, convinced. This practice is natural for people. This practice should be natural for people. This practice is the best thing that can happen to a human being. I still believe that. And we're very lucky that we have been shown the practice, that it has come to us from another place. It's here now, and we have the opportunity to embrace it and make it part of our life. Of course, for us in the world, in this world we live in, the question we have is, that we continue to have is, how do I make this practice work in my life? Especially, how can I take my practice to work where there's so much pressure, so much stress about meeting deadlines, so much work to do, and I can't take time off. What can we do? This practice doesn't fit, you know. The daily life doesn't give me any opportunity. This is a big question. And some people are discouraged by the challenge, you know, what they see is a challenge of bringing this practice into their daily life. And daily life seems to demand speed, ambition, achieving goals, meeting deadlines. This is the environment we have. On the other hand, this practice asks us to slow down. Best you slow down. Best you don't do things under such stress. Best you reflect on your life not in such a rapid way. So this is a major question of Zen students in our culture. How do I apply this practice to my daily life? So there's still confusion. There's still some confusion about this question. And people continue to have trouble finding an answer. And so I've wondered about that for a long time. Why has it been so difficult? And I realized that the question that we are asking we are not starting from the right place and asking this question. So it's very usual when we want to learn something new in our life, like a new skill. We feel that if we want to learn how to do that, I have to learn how to do that. To accomplish a skill, you have to learn the mechanism, the parts of it, and how to take care of them. So this is the world we live in. And in order to learn how to do something, we need to learn something new, some new skill. But the idea of how to do something, that idea, that orientation is for a specific kind of task. How to drive a car. How to fix my music system. How to code. How to do anything. I need to develop a set of steps, maybe even have a user manual or something like that. But our practice is not a task. We misunderstand the question of how to take practice into my life. We will misunderstand that question if we see it as a task. You know what I mean? It's not a task. It's not like learning to code or something like that. Our practice is not a task. Our practice is to express our actual way of life. So, if we see practice as solving a problem, it's a big misunderstanding. If we practice or try to learn how to practice as if we are learning a new technique or a new skill, that is the wrong starting point. That is a misunderstanding. But this is the way we've been trained, you know. And it's hard to find another way. So the teachings of our practice, our teachings tell us where to start. And it's not about learning a skill. It's not about learning techniques. Our practice tells us that we start with the vow that we make, the bodhisattva vow we make. And it includes trusting that we ourselves are inherently bodhisattvas. And this is all throughout the teachings. You can read such things as, you are already enlightened, you are already Buddha, you are inherently a bodhisattva. And we read these things and it doesn't feel like it. How do I become bodhisattva? How do I become Buddha that you're talking about? Whether we receive ordination in some kind of special ceremony makes no difference. We are already Buddha. We are already bodhisattva. This is the teaching. This is the teaching. And how to put that teaching into our life is the big question, is the big effort we have to make. This was Buddha's understanding. He discovered, oh, everything is bodhisattva. Everything is Buddha. Wow. And he came to that understanding by being very quiet and not doing anything but just sitting in meditation. Of course, he didn't have a job to go to. He didn't have to commute. He didn't face the deadlines and the pressures that are with us today. So that's why we provide this practice place, to have a little bit of time and space to be quiet and to come to the understanding that he did, that we are inherently enlightened. We are inherently bodhisattvas, inherently charitable and generous and kind. Our practice starts with trusting that teaching, even though maybe we don't feel it exactly. We start by trusting it. That's the starting point for answering the question, how do I take my practice into my daily life? Without this trust in our inherent self, we cannot extend our practice into our everyday world. And if you read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and Suzuki Roshi always emphasize this point. So when teachings tell us, we are already bodhisattva, it doesn't mean we are a saint, or we are saintly. That's not it. Not some special angel or something. To be a bodhisattva simply means to help others as we would help ourselves or our loved ones, people close to us. Or to help others even more, or even before we would help ourselves. When we have this orientation, then we will learn how to bring practice into our daily life. Suzuki Roshi's son, his son's name is Hoits Suzuki. He's his father's successor. And some years ago, when he was here visiting and gave a lecture, then someone asked him, what is right view? Right view is one of the Eightfold Path. What is right view? And Huweets answered, it is seeing things without delusion. Seeing things without delusion. You know, without fooling ourselves. And he spoke a little bit about that, and he used the metaphor of rose-colored glasses. We all know about that, seeing the world through rose-colored glasses. He used that metaphor. Don't see the world through rosy-colored glasses, because that would be not seeing things as they really are. He called them rosy glasses. When we are wearing rosy glasses, they are the result of our thinking mind, the mind that's evaluating and scheming and trying to create a picture. Wearing rose-colored glasses is one of the things that can happen when we think too much. But we have to think. In our everyday life, we have to exercise our thinking mind. And we have to see things that are in front of us. So we may always have this problem of creating rose-colored glasses because our mind is always is busy thinking about things. So the story of a Buddha sitting very quietly under the tree for a long period of time, not thinking, just being quiet, it means he took off the rosy glasses. This was what Hoeyt said. We don't look at anything in particular. We don't see anything, and we don't think about anything in particular. We just sit quietly, letting the mind disengage from its daily activities. We don't see anything, and we don't think about anything in Zazen. And even though we don't, at that time we are completely in touch and engaged with everything. Even though we don't see things with the physical eye, we are totally engaged and complete with everything. And it's because we have given up trying to understand things with our thinking mind. And that way of understanding is not obstructed by appearances or our desire for the things of the world. So through our Zazen practice, we can come to a complete understanding of who we are and our relationship with each other. This is the right view. As we say, when we trust our practice, when we trust what we are doing, it means we don't feel the need to rely on our thinking mind so much. And we don't feel the need to rely on our physical eyes too much in order to see things as they really are. But when we don't trust our practice, we will be putting on rose-colored glasses and won't be able to see things as they are and won't be able to feel our oneness with everything. So if we see things directly or not, if we think about things directly or not, makes no difference. We are always complete with everything. We are not separated from anything, whether we think about it or not. And feeling our oneness, feeling our connection, feeling how we are not separate, this is more important. This feeling is more important than any ideas we may have about life or about the way we feel about things. This feeling of our connection with each other. That's more important than any ideas about life. So we have our Zazen practice where we make our best effort to sit quietly without any ideas of discrimination. When we can do that, just sit quietly without any ideas, our practice will include everything. This is the basis of the bodhisattva mind. That this is the basis of how we help people, how we help each other. So we sit and we allow the mind to be quiet and not to be so busily engaged with ordinary things. And that way we will develop a feeling. We will develop a trust in our practice. And out of that trust, we will discover how we should really work on things in our life and on what we should be doing with our life. But if we don't trust in our original way, if we don't trust in our bodhisattva nature, we will be confused. We won't know who we are. And we will always strive to be something, anything, just to be able to say, I am something. But if we trust our bodhisattva nature, we know who we are and we don't need to strive to be something. So if we don't trust our bodhisattva nature, we will rely instead on our intellect and on our thinking mind. And we will be continually analyzing the how-to of doing things. And we will lose the chance to find confidence in our fundamental nature. You know, when we do things in everyday life, when we determine what we feel is the best way to do something, in the back of our mind is always the notion that, gee, maybe there's a better way. And that attitude is okay, you know, for taking care of daily life, but that attitude doesn't help us with our spiritual practice. With a bodhisattva attitude, we don't worry about, is there a better way? There's only one way. So in our life, in our daily life, we have many choices. We live right now in a time and place where we have many choices and many opportunities. We have many ways to choose how to do something. And we may not always succeed in what we do because there are no guarantees about anything. And for example, you may be a very devoted and caring parent, generous, patient, providing thoughtful guidance, and you feel you're doing exactly the right thing. But the kids may grow up with an attitude that they may not have the attitude you intended, or maybe even they have values that will surprise you. You never know. There's no guarantees. And at work, you try to be as conscientious and as creative and as hardworking as you can, cooperative and loyal. And after a while, you realize nobody noticed. Nobody notices what you're doing. Or if you start a business, or if you write a book, the world may not accept what you do. No matter how sincere we are, no matter how hard we try, there are no guarantees. That's just the way our life is. So we want to succeed in our daily life with activities that we choose to do, the activities that we think are important and that are beneficial. That feel good, that give us satisfaction. But that success is not the most important point. If we think so, if we depend on that success, we will never understand this practice. It's the feeling that we give to each other that's important. It's the feeling that others have about you That's important. And how you feel about them. The feeling you have about your oneness is important. And having a confident bodhisattva mind is the main thing in life, not your success or lack of it. Success is not guaranteed, or it can come and go, but your bodhisattva mind is forever. And that's where we have to base our practice. To take our spiritual practice from the cushion into our daily life is nothing more than to see things as they are, and not through rosy-colored glasses, and not through our own personal concerns. So we start with a bodhisattva practice, and we learn to see things through the eyes of others, not just through our own eyes. And then, when we do that, whatever activity we do will be a benefit to everyone, to ourselves and everyone. And this is what we mean when we say we take care of things according to Zazen mind. Another way of saying it is to take care of things without discrimination. Whatever we do, whatever task we have in front of us, whoever we're with, whether it's our favorite activity, or whether this person is our favorite person, doesn't make any difference. That's not the point. The bodhisattva mind lets go of the idea of favorite. When we think in terms of favorites, that's wearing rosy-colored glasses. So we just express our true nature fully, no matter what we do, no matter who we're with. So we should do something without that kind of choosing. Is this my favorite thing or not? Sometimes we do something that it makes us feel good. And others too may like it. And others may want to join us in doing it. And we feel this is just right. And sometimes maybe actually it's not so good. May feel good, but actually it's not so good. Sometimes doing something that we don't particularly care for may be the so-called best thing to do. So our practice asks us not to cling to our personal ideas of what is best. Just do. Just take care. This is the basis for our practice. Just take care. Just take care of whatever is in front of us, whoever is in front of us. And this is the best way to take off our rose-colored glasses. And this is the best way to express our practice in our daily life. And does anyone have a question? Umar.
So that's 20 years or so years ago. I did a hotel management degree, and I was first in my class, 95 out of 100, points, and went to my mom and went to my uncle, showed them the results in the paper, which were published in the newspaper, and they said to me, "This is not good enough. You should have gotten 100 points. 95 is not good enough." And came to realize these rose-colored glasses sometimes are given to us by the people who are important to us in our lives. And it becomes really, it can really become a hurdle to, they can really become a hurdle to not carry them around and look through at everyone and everything through the rose-colored glasses. And I think this is why I've started to understand why practice is so important, to come and sit and not be so deluded by all the filters that we're looking at the world.
When we feel the world or other people are judging us and putting expectations on us, pushing us to meet their desires, when we feel that kind of judgment, that's a hard feeling. That's difficult. That causes pain, you know. And how we respond to that so that it doesn't make us crazy, it's a big question. And I think the best way to respond to that, other people's expectation of us, is to understand what we're doing, what we should be doing with our life, how we are living our life, and base our create expectations for ourselves based on those kinds of questions. What is my life? How should I live it? What is its meaning? We set our own expectations, which we can change, which we can modify as our practice matures and our understanding changes. We should listen to the voice of our own expectations, but we should be willing to change them when we feel it's the right thing to do. Sometimes we may feel that we've set expectations for ourselves that are rosy-colored. When we realize that, we can change our expectations to what's real, what's realistic, and what is without discrimination. But it is hard in life when other people push their expectations on us. That's hard. It can be hard. That's why we're fortunate to have this practice. Thank you.
It seems that I remember some time ago hearing you say that excitement is something maybe to be avoided. And that I'm hearing about your excitement 50 years ago when you started Zen. And something seems right about both statements. As you were talking about the rosy-colored glasses, I was sort of wondering if maybe it's not the excitement itself, but maybe some kind of embellishment that we add to the pursuit of the excitement. I wonder if you could expand on that.
Well, I don't think we can avoid excitement. sometimes things happen to us or around us or to somebody we're associated with, and it touches us, and we get excited. But we should allow that excitement to have its own life and not try to extend it beyond the initial rush, which happens. We can't turn off the rush. So we enjoy it, but we have to be careful of not stringing it along or creating a story around it. Excitement is often a very good motivator for us to go do something that's useful and helpful and lead us to understanding something that was not clear before. So if I said we shouldn't be excited, that isn't quite right. We can't help it. Just how we handle it, how we let it inform us and not overwhelm us, this, I think, is the main point. Thank you.
You had said that you were very excited when you first discovered Zen, but also I recall that the very first time or two that you sat, you said, "Well, this was difficult. I'll never do this again." What was it that brought you back in those first couple of times?
A feeling, a sense of something that I could not explain. Just beyond explanation.
And the other question I wanted to ask was, how do you think your life might have been different if you hadn't started this practice when you did as a young man?
Oh, I've thought about that a lot. And there are many possible answers. And I don't know which one rises to the top. I think not very satisfied. I would not be satisfied. Because when I found the practice, it sort of said to me, "You're really not satisfied with what you're doing, are you? This practice is showing you the way to find satisfaction." So if I had not have found the practice, I'm not sure I would have found what would bring me satisfaction in life. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, I don't know. I don't have a clear answer to your question. I might have gone on to say, "Gee, this is working pretty well. It's fine. I don't need anything else. I'm completely happy, satisfied, successful. I have everything." It might have gone that way. Or it might have gone to despair. I don't know. I doubt it. I had some nice things in my life that would not have allowed that to happen. Mm-hmm. But I think my life would not have felt totally fulfilled without this practice. Maybe satisfied, but not 100% fulfilled. Something like that.
You spoke a little bit about things that could be popular but might not be the right thing. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit about the difference between being a people pleaser and fulfilling the bodhisattva vow.
The difference or contrast or...
About sometimes it's, you might feel that you're following your vow, but really it's easy to people please, to make everyone around you happy.
Oh.
It can be tricky.
Maybe sometimes we do have to try to make people feel good. Sometimes the situation calls for that. Try to make people feel happy, but instead of trying to make people feel happy, I think it's more important to let people know that you see them, that you understand them, that you acknowledge them, that you affirm them, that you are there. I think if we don't want to it's better if people do not develop the habit of needing to be to have somebody else make them feel good. I think sometimes we develop that kind of habit. We need other people to affirm us. We need people to say the thing that will make us feel good. Better that we feel good about ourselves because of what we do and how we do things and our relationships. So sometimes if we're with someone and we sense that they're maybe unhappy right now or don't feel so good, and maybe we want to say something that temporarily provides some comfort, but more important is to let them know that we understand, that we are there, that we see what's going on, that they're not alone. That we see them and hear them. Sometimes somebody may say to you, I just wanted to make sure that you heard me. This is part of Bodhisattva mind.
Is the best way to take off your rose-colored glasses to first help other people take off theirs? In other words, kind of a concrete example, I see people in my neighborhood in Palo Alto who put a lot of pressure on their kids, like Mark was talking about. And in doing so, they put rose-colored glasses on their kids. Where is if they would do the opposite, if they would learn to see their kids' lives through their kids' eyes and to feel what their kids are feeling and to empathize with them, essentially helping them take off those rose-colored glasses, they would see their own life different. And in doing so, they would take off their glasses as well. So it's kind of complicated, but is that the way to remove your own rose-colored glasses, to first help other people take theirs off?
It starts with being really honest with ourselves. Have confidence in what we're doing and to make our best effort to understand, to really understand each situation and not to make assumptions or projections or project our own desires onto relationship. So, being honest with ourselves, not wearing any artificial lenses. Starting there, we can find ways that will encourage people to do the same. Maybe, no guarantees, but that's the effort we make. Be honest with ourselves.